The mouth. The mouth on each already opening to allow that second mouth of razor-sharp teeth to protrude as they came toward them, hundreds of long feet waving and, beneath the double mouths, the forcibles clicking away, ready to claw and tear. "Fire!" Angela commanded. And they did, as a team. They aimed for the giant heads with the mammoth flamethrowers. Yes, yes, fire is good. Fire decreased the acid dropping from the things. It burnt up in the flames. It enhanced them. "Cover me!" she shouted. She had come to the bottom of the stairs. Huge tunnels existed, but cast-off rocks and ledges surrounded them. She made a dive behind the rock where she'd seen the little girl. The child had ceased to scream. She had ceased to do anything but shake and stare in horror. "Tarleton!" she screamed. There was no answer. Neither did she see the man. She didn't see any of his body parts either. But then again, would she? The earth was burnt out and scorched from the acid and the flamethrowers. There was blood here and there and pieces of a colonial marine uniform still attached to flesh. Angela wrapped her arms around the child. She looked back to the Marines and the android. "Heading back!" she cried. "Incoming!" the android, Tommy Two, shouted, lifting his weapon. "Run!" he told her. She did. Enough for their first excursion down. She was pretty sure that at least one of the three creatures they'd encountered was dead. The other two continued to thrash, legs flying about, teeth and forcibles clicking away. She ran straight up the stairs, followed by the Marines. As she reached the top step and the entrance to the cave, she burst out into the dying light of the day, the child still clutched in her arms, Marines behind her, firing, firing. She heard the sound, that awful sound the xenomorphs seemed to make, no matter what hybrid creation they might be. "I know that sound. Know it far too well. It had haunted far too many of my dreams." Lieutenant Colonel Simon Nicholson seemed to have come to and gained back some of his senses since she, along with the android and the three Marines, had gone into the cave. He was shouting out orders to a new wave of soldiers. "Flamethrowers! Flamethrowers!" he ordered. Angela held the little girl close as she raced toward his command center. When she tried to put the little girl down, the child clung to her.
"Jake! Jake! Uncle Warwick went to find him. Jake, my brother, you have to get my brother and my Uncle Warwick. Please. Oh!"
The little girl started to sob. Holding her, Angela blinked. Uncle Warwick. So, the cop who had come for her had done so with good and personal reason. The kids were his nephew and niece. But he hadn't offered her up for nothing. He'd known what he was facing. And he'd known that she was a better bet than the lieutenant colonel who was still there blustering about.
"Okay. What's your name?" she asked the child. "Dublin."
"Your name is Dublin?" The little girl nodded solemnly.
"They say it was a place."
"Yes, it was a place. A beautiful place, so I was told," Angela murmured. "Okay, you have to let me go." The child's hold on her was so tight. "Dublin, baby, you have to let me go, or I won't be able to go back in. I won't be able to find your Uncle Warwick or your brother." "What the fuck?" Lieutenant Colonel Simon Nicholson said suddenly. Angela swung around. She'd just managed to set Dublin down. She picked her back up. The alien centipede xenomorphs had discovered the way out of the cave. They'd killed one. She knew that they had killed one, but there were now several that had spilled out of the cave, great heads atop long bodies with those hundreds of long legs, and the rear of the creatures seeming to whip around as if they were scorpion-tailed, and the click-click-click of the forcibles in front of the bodies, beneath the giant heads with the double mouths, and the shimmering, sharp teeth that dripped with the saliva of a constant hunger. She wrenched Dublin off the ground and into her arms, running for one of the marine trucks. She thought about the way that the beings had been killed in the past. So convenient when you could blast the acid-dripping monsters into darkest space. "Think," she told herself. "Think." Fire worked, but they needed so much of it. Marines were running everywhere. fighting, and dying. Angela shoved Dublin into the passenger side of a marine trunk. "Stay. Don't move. Don't come out." Dublin nodded and then screamed. Angela swung around in time to see one of the xenomorphs bearing down on her. She just had time to draw her heavy weapon to send fire surging toward the creature. The head caught fire, burned. The thing screamed in a horrible dance of death just as she looked up. One of the Marines who had so bravely followed her had just been skewered by at least 4 of the legs on one of the creatures.
"What are we going to do? What are we going to do? What are we going to do?"
Lieutenant Colonel Nicholson demanded. He was by her side, trying to push by her to get into the vehicle along with the child, Dublin. Angela ignored him. Another of the things was coming toward her, forcibles clicking, teeth shimmering in the glow of the vehicle lights. Night was coming fast upon them. She turned suddenly, catching him by the lapels.
"What's that other cave entrance? More silver?"
He shook his head, staring at her as if he'd become crazed.
"Salt. Rock salt."
Salt. Rock salt. She remembered being a child on a Milky Way planet similar to Earth, and the neighbor boy who had thrown rocks at cats and dogs and enjoyed setting lizards on fire. He'd also poured salt over centipedes and watched while they squirmed and died. Centipedes. Yes, at the heart of it all, they were vulnerable. She'd studied the creatures. She loved the earth and farming and animal husbandry.
"Salt!" she screamed the word. "Salt! Tons of it! Salt and fire! Salt and fire!"
"Yes, ma'am," Tommy Two called out. The rear end of a centipede xenomorph thing was swinging around for her. She ducked and rolled far away. She was headed for the rock salt cave entrance. But then she saw him, the little boy. He must have been a year or two older than his sister. His name, she knew, was Jake. He had made his way to the entrance. He was alone. One of the xenomorphs was headed for him. Did that mean that Chief Warwick Tarleton was dead? Most likely, she thought. And though she hadn't known him that well, she was saddened. He'd known the truth. He'd been ready to fight no matter what the battle. She had been afraid. He had forced her to courage.
"Jake, get down!" she shouted.
She could see one of them. It had been injured. It was missing several legs. It still had enough. It was stumbling toward the boy. Angela raced for it, firing away with her flamethrower. It made a horrible sound. She knew to aim for the head and the eyes. She kept her aim steady. She almost had it down. And then she ran out. Her flamethrower sputtered. The things were not stupid. No matter what the host creature, they seemed to come out with a frightening level of intelligence. It started toward her and the boy. Well, that was it then. She'd escaped once, and now. She waved her arms at the creature, running to the left of the boy.
"Run, Jake, run! See the Colonial Marine truck over there? Run! The shell is resistant to the acid and fire and bullets. Run! Run! And you... oh, my God, you are ugly. Come here. Come here."
She waited. One of the legs would stab through her body any second. The leg would lift her, bear her to the chomping inner mouth of the repulsive beast. Maybe it was just her turn.
"Go ahead, you bastard," she cried.
Suddenly, flames whipped before, tearing into the thing. She heard it let out one of its terrible screams, and she spun around. Chief Tarleton was there. He'd swept up a flamethrower, probably from one of the fallen Marines.
"The salt is coming," he cried.
She stared at him. Salt. Will it work? The Marines were coming. They were minus their commander and Cousin Joe. They were accompanied, though, by the android. Tommy, too. Tommy was hauling some kind of a massive machine with a great big nozzle. She stared at it, still somewhat in shock, as the man at her side burned down the xenomorph that had been so very close to ending her life. It was going down, but others were now peeking out the entrance to the cave.
"Duck!" Warwick called to her. "Duck! Roll!"
She fell to the ground. He fell with her, forcing the two of them to roll fast and furiously away, far away from the opening to the cave. From there she saw that the Marines had come up with tons and tons of the rock salt. They'd loaded it into the machine with the massive nozzle. The android, Tommy Two, leapt up to the controls of the machine. And he let loose. Rock salt, hard, loose, started to fly. And fly and fly and fly in a colorful rain, like hail, like rainbow-infused snow flurries. So many minerals were part of the mined rock salt, the colors seemed to be endless. It was almost beautiful, large and small, like hair, like a delicate spray it flew and flew. It landed upon the creatures, and in the darkness, they seemed to catch those colors as they screamed in a crescendo, melting like the Witch of the West when she was doused with water. The Marines all about went still, watching. The night sky seemed to take on the colors. One by one they went down, and when they were down, Marines rushed over them in waves, burning the remains, chopping them to ribbons with their knives and guns and bayonets. Tommy, too, didn't stop. He drove the machine to the front of the cave. He filled it with rock salt. It was almost like fireworks. She stood by the Marine truck next to Warwick Tarleton and watched. Bit by bit, the night came to an end. Tommy, too, crawled down from the machine. "Thank you. That was brilliant," Angela told him. He smiled. "I can't lie. I can't kill human beings. I can't allow them to die if it is in my power to stop them dying. You gave me the power." She shook her head, waving a hand in the air. "No, no, you knew what you were doing. The Marines are good." She could go home, she thought. Home to the little house and lovely little farm she had going. They were far, far away from... No, they were never far, far away from danger. She couldn't hide from it. She realized it was over, and the Marines were all staring at her. "Nice, Captain! Nice!" one of the young men called out to her. "Hurrah!" went up. She lifted her hands, flushing. She'd lost what she'd had that morning, she realized. Her life of illusion, where she believed that she could hide, that she could find a world that was safe from all dangers. Warwick Tarleton was there, too, nodding in grim acknowledgement of the Marines and her. She turned and saw that there were many body parts here and there. Though a great deal of death had occurred before the creatures were stopped, Lieutenant Colonel Simon Nicholson was still alive and well, and whole. She thought that he would immediately try to regain control, seize back his authority. "I didn't do it. I swear I didn't do it." No. He wanted no control, and Angela believed him. Chief Tarleton spoke, a protective hand on his nephew's head, another on his niece's head. "Your cousin, Joe Nicholson. Your father brought in the Blue Moon Giant centipedes. That would ensure that the mines were dug out. But Joe couldn't let that be enough. You were the one in control. He might have been the better soldier, but you were heir to your dad."
"My dad? No... Really? No,"
Simon Nicholson said. He didn't believe his own words.
"Maybe Joe was eaten," Tommy Two said. "I don't see him."
"Here he is." A pretty young female Marine walked up, dragging Joe along with her. "He's alive. He ran the minute the real action started."
Don't kill me. Don't kill me. Don't kill me," the man blubbered.
Chief Tarleton wrenched him by the collar.
"You're under arrest, Sergeant," he said, addressing the young Marine. "If you would see this man to the joint barracks, I believe that what he's done does call for banishment to a penal colony, but hell, I'm not judge and jury."
"Yes, Chief," the Marine said. Warwick Tarleton was staring across the space at Angela. She smiled crookedly as the Marines went about their work. They saw to their injured and their dead. "Thank you," Tarleton said to her. As if they had been cued, which of course they hadn't, she would have seen them. The children rushed to Angela, putting their arms around her.
"Thank you, thank you,"
she nodded ruefully.
So, I'm not under arrest anymore?
I knew you'd rise to the occasion. You know, they're probably going to try to talk you into coming back, into taking command here, Tarleton told her.
Maybe I could be a reserve, she said. She studied him. I'm impressed. Joe Nicholson, good old Cousin Joe. He got a lot of people killed. He nearly got the kids killed. And yet you refrained. You didn't even give him a belt in the jaw. I might have been tempted to do that.
If I'd have touched him, I'd have killed him, Tarleton said. And, well, I cling to whatever it is that makes us human, that makes us different, that lifts us above the creatures. I mean, well, we see evil in some of our own kind, right? Beasts lurk in all of us. But so does something higher, he added very softly. So, I'll get you home. I mean, the Marines will get this under control. I wrenched you away from your farm. Still studying the man, she nodded. She liked him. Really liked him. Him and the damned android. And a lot of the Marines. She hadn't liked anyone that way since... since Daniel had died. But then she hadn't known anyone who would take such risks for others since then. You're not moving, he said. So does that bode well for the future of this fine group of Marines?
Maybe, she said. But you're right. We need some higher authority. For now... She ruffled the kid's hair and asked, Are you hungry? I grow really great food on my farm.
Hungry? Jake said. Starving!
If your uncle says it's okay, Angela murmured.
It's okay. I mean, I get to eat too, right?
Sure.
They walked past the trucks and the fires, back to the hover car.
Pretty tricky, though.
When you came to get me, you didn't mention that the children were your niece and nephew, Angela said. He gazed over Jake's head and smiled. I try to be noble, he said. Then he lowered his head, smiling. And, of course, I try to avoid stupidity as well.
Angela laughed. Her beautiful world, created and false in so many ways, had nearly been destroyed. But that night, she thought that there was a new kind of beauty around her. It still existed in a created world. And yet, it was beautifully real.
Hugs to Die For by Mike Resnick and Marina J. Lostetter. Xenomorph blood is one of the most corrosive substances known to man, ideal for use in construction and cutting. Now that you've seen how the company has perfected its procurement and retainment methodology, we think you'll agree that its employment here on your base is not only safe, but is indeed quite a boon. Said Mr. Jones, the wide-eyed tour guide, skipping ahead of the small group with his clipboard in hand, eager to reach the final stop on their journey. Here we come to the pride and joy of our facility, where the root of the magic happens. Jones waved grandly at the floor-to-ceiling windows of the Egg Lab as they approached. White padded paneling lined the hall outside the lab, and two armed guards stood stoically at its entrance. General Amatz, along with her small security detail of two, nodded respectfully to the men as they passed. She only half noticed what Jones said at any given moment. His PR training had been thorough, but was completely lost on a Marine of her caliber. Her superiors hadn't interrupted her leave for a tour of the half-constructed military space station because she needed a good dog and pony show. They'd called on her because the task was urgent, and she was the nearest high-ranking official. Due to recent encounters elsewhere with xenomorph populations, the company's perfected methods had come into question, and the Colonial Marines had decided they needed a closer look at the systems being used to construct their base. So they'd wrangled her an invitation and assigned poor Ribar and Cortez, who'd also been on leave, as security. Marines on vacation had been the only ones close enough, which was why the base was being constructed here in the first place. There wasn't enough of a permanent military presence nearby. Inside the lab, robotic arms slid back and forth on thick tracks mounted to the ceiling, operated and monitored by the technicians in the control booth, stationed a short distance away from both the lab and the adjoining egg vault. They'd finished touring the booth only a few minutes prior, and having seen the contents of the lab on the array of monitors, General Amatz was eager to get a closer look at its contents. As they drew up close to the windows, Amatz found herself squinting. The light in the hall was blindingly bright, while the bulbs within were dimmed. The black metal arms moved with an eerie precision and were jointed in such a way as to appear organic when not properly lit. The ends of several looked like hands with elongated fingers. Others sported pincers, and one looked like a barbed extremity, flicking back and forth near the edge of the window, right where the hall lights created the greatest glare. It could have easily been a tail, ready to strike, to cut, to stab. It looked as though it lay in wait for one of the unsuspecting humans to draw closer, to lose it in the shimmer of the glass.
"If you'll all move closer," Mr. Jones beckoned, sidling up himself, nearer to the seam, nearer to that suspicious robotic arm. Amatz caught her heart beating inexplicably fast in her chest. She was so eager to see one of these creatures in person, her mind was creating monsters where there were none. With a burst of speed, the arm she'd been eyeing shot sideways into the room, out of its dark corner. It moved to a large tank, occupying one-third of the space, tracing over the glass like a protective mother. Yellow liquid filled the tank, and the solution sat absolutely still. Not so much as a ripple fluttered through the murky film. But the tank wasn't empty. Mr. Jones had already explained that was where they kept the neutralized facehuggers. Hundreds of them. She squinted again, trying to discern shapes in the preservation fluid. There, perhaps, was something that looked like the bony, pale fingers of an emaciated man. It twitched, or the light flickered, or her eyes refocused, and the phantom shape disappeared.
"Now," Jones began, "if you'll look to the right of the lab, you'll see..."
"Ma'am? General? Mr. Rabar? Sorry to interrupt." The young aide with whom Rabar had left his son sidled up, looking sheepish, sliding her glasses higher up her nose. "Daniel is asking for you. He said it was time for his medication, but you didn't leave me anything."
Rabar looked annoyed. This had been a last-minute assignment for all of them, and he had tried to refuse because of having no one to place his son with. Amatz had suggested the kid simply come along. After all, this was only a milk run. Rabar emitted a heavy sigh. "He doesn't take any medication," he said. The aide looked confused. "He's messing with you," Rabar continued. "10-year-olds do that."
A too wide smile flitted over the aide's face and away again. "Oh, of course. I'm sorry."
"Who's with him now?"
The aide's cheeks blanched. "No one. I left him in the quarters we assigned you."
Amatz decided to intervene. "Go check on him, just to be on the safe side."
The woman hurried away.
Cortez bit back a laugh. "God, she's too easy."
The tour guide seemed puzzled, looking for all the world like he'd just witnessed an exchange in a foreign language.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Jones," Amatz said. "Please continue." "As I was saying, if you will focus your attention to the right, we'll start the neutralization process."
To the right was a large, dark cage with thick struts and corrugated slats. It butted up against a thick, gray vault door, slashed in many places with claw marks.
Beneath the door ran a length of conveyor belt, which ground into motion, groaning and screeching as its guide wheels turned. As the vault door slid upwards, a trapdoor at the end of the belt slid aside. A white plastic and stainless steel figure rose, hunchbacked, from the floor. It looked both ghostly and broken within the dark grasp of the cage. It was a mannequin in the approximate shape of a human, much as a poorly wired skeleton bears that same approximate human shape. Its ovoid head lulled on its shoulders. With a flick of some unseen technician's wrist, the dummy came half alive, lifting its head and opening its wide, devilish mouth, revealing whirling gears and clamps within. A small blue pilot light glimmered behind its metal teeth. Through the vault door slid a brownish-green egg, looking like the skin might flake but the tissues would give under one's touch, like a dried-out corpse. Only there was nothing dry about the ovomorph. Long strands of amniotic goo trailed over and around the egg like so much saliva. Amatz unconsciously raised her hand to her throat, gulping down harshly. There are three known types of stimulants that signal to the egg and facehugger that a receptive host is nearby, said Jones, as though describing something as benign as a bake sale. Not all huggers respond to the same stimulants, so we employ them all. One, movement of a warm body. The mannequin inside the cage did a terrible parody of a dance. Two, mammalian pheromones. The tail robot shot across the room as if it meant to spear the ovomorph. Instead, it spritzed a heavy mist over the quad-fold lips of the egg, which gave no signs of stirring. Amatz imagined that she could smell musk in the air. And three, carbon dioxide emissions. It's the same way bedbugs find their victims. And with a puff of gas from another robotic extension, the pliant lips unfurled. Amatz tensed as a single bony leg inched its way above the folds, twitching once as if testing the air. In the next instant, it sprang, leaping at the mannequin with legs splayed wide, like a giant grasping hand. The dummy welcomed it with a deranged grin as the slimy, whip-like tail of the creature noosed itself around its throat. Moments later, the hugger's arms were wrapped around the thing's head, with its reproductive organs plastered grotesquely to the mannequin's mouth. "Watch," Jones insisted. Seconds in, the creature began violently seizing, a few of its legs twitching away from the mannequin's head as though it longed to let go. From above, a thin beam of red sliced through the knot of the alien's tail, cauterizing the wound as quickly as it cut. Facehuggers could not scream. They made only autonomic sounds. But it was clear from the way it thrust itself away, falling back onto the floor with its legs curling in the air like a dead spider, that it was in pain. We cauterize the proboscis, the tube that implants the parasitic cells which help morph the host tissue into a chest burster, and remove the tail. As you can see, robbed of its ability to complete its biological imperative, the hugger becomes docile and safe to work with. As Jones droned on, a set of black metal pincers entered the cage to retrieve the animal. It twitched as the arm clutched around it, like a bug poked with a stick. It remained half-curled, still as death, until the arm was within reach of the tank. Sensing, somehow, that it was about to be imprisoned with the rest of its kind, the hugger jerked violently, again and again. Its claw-tipped legs scraped at the pincers, scratching long silver lines into the arm. The creature twisted and squirmed, and the technician tightened the grip. Big mistake. One leg pinched and tore, extruding a glob of yellow-green blood that foamed and sizzled as it sank into the softening metal. The arm gave an abortive jolt, still heading for the tank, but now listing to the side. The technician lost control and it careened into the glass, cracking the side. The pincers popped open, dropping the flailing creature unceremoniously onto the floor. Cortez and Ribar immediately unholstered their sidearms, and the station guards at the end of the hall jolted to attention. Simultaneously, a siren blared out, and flashing yellow lights filled the space.
"It's all right," Jones said, holding out his hands, moving between the Marines and the windows. "We have containment procedures. It's fine. We have to be prepared for accidents when working with animals. The lab's on lockdown. We've gone through this before. It's fine."
"Look, General," Cortez pointed frantically at the tank, where a handful of facehuggers had begun to swim at the crack. One after the other, they threw themselves at the weak point, but to no avail.
"It's fine," Jones wheezed. It didn't look fine.
Amatz's heart began to skip beats, thumping harder first in her ears, then her belly, as if it was clamoring for a way out. More huggers joined the assault. More and more of the supposedly docile, supposedly incapacitated aliens banged themselves in unison against the crack, widening it, sending little spiderweb fractures through the tank until the tank shattered, sending a great whooshing wall of liquid spilling into the lab proper. Hundreds of huggers scrambled through the flood, shaking themselves like dogs, their breathing flaps expanding and contracting lightning quick to shed droplets of the preservation fluid. Hundreds of them. Hundreds. All clammy skin and knobby joints, with no desire but to breed. Breed. Breed.
"Still fine," Jones insisted, grabbing Cortez's wrist, yanking it away from his weapon. "They're contained, and you have to remember they've been neutered. They are harm-"
A wave of them rushed at the glass, sensing the warm bodies beyond. Their burnt-out reproductive organs thumped at the pane, smearing it with a combination of fluids. Their nails scraped like little rat feet at the glass and at each other. The pile grew as more and more of them leapt onto one another in a crazed push to get at the humans. As the Marines raised their guns, taking steady aim, the general signaled for the guards to join them.
"You two, come on and get more men down here. We're going to need all the firepower we can get." "General," Jones complained, "this is unnecessary. We are..."
She grabbed him by the collar, yanking him off balance. "If you say fine again, so help me, I will break your ratty little nose." The pile grew and grew until all one could see was a mass of legs, legs, and more legs. Three facehuggers pinned themselves flat against the glass, sprawled out completely to extend to their full wingspan. They formed a triangle that looked deliberate.
"Shit's going to happen real quick," she spat at Jones. "I know strategizing when I see it, and those things aren't just some dumb bugs, so you better find a hole to crawl into."
She dismissed him with an expression of total disdain. He straightened his shirt.
"I'm not going anywhere. I have full confidence in the company and in our lockdown procedures."
"Look around," she snapped.
"You're the only one. If you shoot them, you will destroy this facility. Their blood will eat through everything."
"I'm not the one who thought it was a good idea to bring sentient acid bombs aboard and then piss them off." Cortez shouted as the three splayed huggers were simultaneously speared through by their comrades. The creatures tore at their legs, their backs, their breathing flaps. In moments, the sacrificial aliens were obscured by the volume of blood splattered across the massive swath of window. The glass fell away like so much melting sugar, leaving nothing but dead air between the humans and the horde of angry parasitoids.
"Fire!"
commanded the general, gesturing for everyone to back away down the hall as they shot. The high-pitched crack of a handgun was underscored by the bass booms of the guards' rifles. Creatures leapt into the air, their legs outstretched, clamping down wherever they landed. Others scrambled up the walls, and the rest darted out underfoot. Chaos reigned, and everything blurred. There were so many bodies, so many legs. They carpeted the surfaces, pouring over one another, flowing like an eager sea of spiders, only much worse. Mr. Jones literally wet his pants, and the rank scent of ammonia mingled with the sour smell of corroding metals. Acid flew all around, barrels flashed, ozone burned, Ribar cried out in agony as a long glob of yellow blood hit his shin, searing it down to the bone. As he stumbled, Amatz took his weapon from him. "Call the ship in," she commanded him. "We have to get out of here. Let them know it's an emergency evacuation situation." He opened up a link. Their ship sat in orbit around the planet, waiting for their day aboard the station to be completed. It was supposed to take them all back to Earth. All of them. Even Ribar's kid. "Shit. Don't let a single one out of here," she yelled. "We have to protect the rest of the base." A facehugger leapt at Cortez just as he emptied his clip. He flung his arms in front of his face, and the alien latched onto his gun. He tossed it away. A guard tripped, and a hugger clamped around his knee, ineffectually trying to tongue at him with the cauterized stump of its proboscis. After a moment, it pulled itself tighter, curling in, putting extra pressure right on the kneecap until... crack! The man's screams echoed down the narrow hall. Out of the corner of her eye, Amatz saw a new shape in the melee. It wasn't bony and knobbed, not heavy and fleshy. It was long, like a whip, like a tail. "They're not all neutered," she breathed, sure no one could hear her over the racket of shots plus acid fizzle. Some of the huggers must have burned their way into the egg vault, clawed their way into the unopened eggs. One with a tail sprang from the floor 2 feet in front of her. "Watch out!" she yelled to no one in particular. The creature's target lay behind, over her shoulder. She whipped around, just in time to see it clamp down on Mr. Jones, his last words smothered by the coil around his neck and the tube down his throat. Whatever he'd been about to say, fine wasn't it. Mr. Jones went limp, his body collapsing like a sack of loose bones. He hit the deck before Amatz could loose another yelp. "Protect your mouths," Amatz ordered. "We have live ones, live ones." But it was no use. The newborn facehuggers were protected by their brethren. Wounded individuals took bullets for them. The group's imperative to impregnate drove them like a hive mind. First Jones went down, then Cortez on her left, the capped guard on her right. The second guard turned to her, ready to shout something, when one leapt and caught the side of his mouth with 3 legs, yanking his lips wide before it burrowed in. Amatz took the last mag from Ribar, determined to protect him. "Daniel," he choked, his fingers clawing at his bloodied leg. "You'll see him again. You will." The facehugger numbers dwindled, but not because they'd killed so many. Holes littered the floor like perfect bug-sized escape hatches. She could only watch in horror as many crawled down and away, disappearing into the inner workings of the space station. "We have to get the hell out of here," she gasped in Ribar's ear. "Can you walk at all on your own? The docking bay's not that far. The ship is on its way." "But Daniel, I'll get him. Me. You'd only slow us down." As the last of the creatures wormed its way out of sight, she handed Ribar his service pistol. "No, I have to. You want to play the hero, or do you want to give your kid the best chance of survival? I order you to get to the docking bay." He nodded solemnly. "I'm sorry," he mumbled, before going. "It was supposed to be my job to protect you, to keep you alive." "You haven't failed yet. Get your ass out of here." He saluted, then was gone. Minus a weapon,
She inched her way toward one of the downed guards. The man's lungs still worked steadily, but as she came closer, the alien on his face tightened its grip. "Easy, easy," she whispered at it, crouching down to snake the rifle from the man's fingers. She checked the mag, half empty. "I'm sorry," she said, echoing Ribar. She knew the guard couldn't hear her, knew he was dead already. The only thing he had to look forward to was a larval xenomorph punching its way out of his diaphragm. "I'm sorry," she said again, backing up a safe distance to take aim at his head and fire. She did the same for the other guard, and Jones, and Cortez, choking each time she pulled the trigger. Plastering herself to the wall, eyes darting, she carefully slid out of the lab hall and into the open causeway. Just 6 corridors separated her from the kid, but it was thousands of cubic meters in which Murphy's Law could have a field day. Out on the causeways, all lay eerily still. Only the incessant emergency siren blared out, so constant and steady it was nothing but white noise. She hunched as she moved, ready to fire or spring out of a hugger's path any second. Sweat dripped from her hairline into her eyes. She felt too hot and too cold at the same time, and her gaze was never steady. Every moment that passed had her more skittish than the next. What if she didn't make it in time? What if she got there and Daniel was already on the floor, a cold, eyeless mask of a creature covering his face? Ribar would have every right to blame her. She passed several such unfortunates on her way, bodies sprawled out, unwilling incubators for xenomorph flesh. She didn't have enough rounds to put them all down, and her chest constricted every time she made the choice to move on without ending someone's pain. Many of the hallways were cordoned off with yellow tape, and a few areas were swathed in opaque plastic, behind which amorphous shadows faded in and out of the light. The scent of hot metal mixed with some kind of sour astringent taint in the air. Every time she caught an extra strong whiff of the acidic smell, she jerked away, sure it meant a hugger was upon her. 10 meters from her goal, one fully functioning bug dropped from the ceiling. She dove for the floor, bruising her knees, but avoiding the clutch of long legs. Its nails sliced down her back in the mist, creating hot lines of pain. Swiftly, unthinkingly, blood pounding in her ears, she rolled over and fired, clipping the creature square in the center as it leapt for her face. Its bony body shattered on impact, and a light splattering of acid singed her right cheek. The acid bore little holes into her skin, creating deep open wounds, but she made no attempt to wipe it away. She knew she'd only get an injured hand for her efforts. It didn't matter that it would scar. Didn't matter that she could feel it eating through to the wet flesh of her mouth. Nothing mattered. Not pain. Not time. Not breath. Until she reached Daniel. It was her fault he was here. It was her responsibility to get him out. The door, when she reached it, was locked. She racked her brain for the aide's name. Miss Campbell, open the door. It's General Amatz. A feral screech came from within, but the door snapped open. Blinking up at her from the other side was Daniel. Quickly, she shuffled the boy inside, pulling the door behind her. Miss Campbell was curled in one corner of the square room, between a desk and a cot. "Come on, we have to go, now," Amatz demanded. "What's happening?" Daniel asked, calm and clear-eyed. "I have to get you to your daddy, okay? He wanted to come, but I gave him a job to do, so he had to do it. Understand?" She took his hand firmly in her free one, towing the door back open and scanning the hall. "Take Miss Campbell's hand, too." "No," the aide said dully. Amatz barely glanced at her, preoccupied with setting herself up for a sprint. Fine, don't take his hand.
I'm not going out there.
You don't have a choice. Campbell hugged her knees to her chest, burying her face against them.
I'm not going,
came her muffled whimper. Look, I'm not in the habit of convincing people to do what I say. I give orders. Marines follow them. It's as simple as that.
I'm not a...
I know. So you get to choose. Come with me, or die here. A long pause followed.
Come on, Amatz silently urged.
Get up. I can't save you if you aren't willing to be saved.
I'll just wait here. Someone will come.
I came. No one else is about to.
Campbell looked up, her gaze unfocused, voice steady. I said no.
Amatz wasn't going to treat her like a child. Maybe a person with less sense and a bigger savior complex would have forced her on her feet, but not the general. She knew you couldn't make a flailing man swim, and you couldn't make a grown woman choose a death push over hiding. Amatz respected that, but she also had an obligation to Daniel. They couldn't hesitate any longer. Hell, maybe Campbell was right. Maybe someone else would rescue her. Amatz could only hope. She squeezed Daniel's hand tighter. You ready, kid? His wide eyes locked with hers as he nodded, looking half his age and twice as delicate. Don't let go of my hand, no matter what else you do, okay?
Okay.
Ready? We're going to run real fast. You let me know if you see any critters, okay? She took a deep cleansing breath. 3, 2, 1. Daniel stumbled almost as soon as they were out the door. She yanked him up by the arm, half dragging him along, but she could see that this wasn't going to work.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry,
he gasped immediately, eyes watering. Amatz was sure Campbell hadn't explained to him what the sirens were for, but the kid wasn't stupid. He knew bad shit was going down. He was trembling and trying to hurry, but it wasn't enough. Hey, I've got an idea, she said. Can you hold on tight if I give you a piggyback ride? It was too big to carry on her hip, and she needed her hands free for the rifle. He wiped his nose on his sleeve.
Yeah?
Good. Up then. She crouched for him. They weren't more than 2 meters away from the door, were moving too slow and making too much noise. 3 facehuggers rounded a corner, sneaking out from beneath a flap of brittle plastic. 2 tailless wonders and 1 fully functioning baby maker. Quicker, Daniel. Quick. Hold on. Hide your face. Whatever you do, don't look up. Head down. She rose to her feet before he was fully in place, and his little shoes scrambled against her sides. Hold on. Hold as tight as you can. The hugger's legs stuttered against the pipes of the ceiling, tapping out a harsher staccato pattern the closer they came. Amatz got her hands fixed on her weapon at the same time Daniel stopped squirming. She fired in rapid succession, taking all 3 out. Acid dribbled onto the deck as though from a leaky faucet, while the alien corpses still clung to the ceiling. She skirted her way around it. The boy bounced against her back as they ran, and his forearm cut tight across her throat, making it difficult to breathe. But their pace was good. They could make it. 1 haul down, then 2. A few more corners, and they were halfway to home. Hang on, kid, she choked out, trying to sound as reassuring as possible. Her breaths came high and tight, and a half-sizzle, half-roar swelled in her ears. Whether it was her veins throbbing or a side effect of hyperventilating, she couldn't say. The bow in her spine ached, and her knees wobbled, but she knew she could make it. She could keep putting 1 foot in front of the other and get Daniel to safety. She came to the last corner, around which lay the lab hall and the final stretch to the docking bay. Almost there! The elation died on her lips as she skidded to a halt. At the far end of the hall, Wires and flex pipes dangled out of the ceiling like vines in a titanium jungle. They swayed to and fro with the movement of dozens of facehuggers skittering up and down the ridged surfaces. Coolant leaked from several pipe ends, forming a pool below that was quickly covering over with a temperature-induced haze. Most of the bugs were neutered, but a handful of healthy huggers climbed up and down the vines in double time, walking over their siblings, using them as surer footing. They created a curtain that spanned the entire width of the hall. They know. Somehow those breeding parasitic bastards know this is our escape route. Remember what I said, Daniel. Don't look up. Amatz thought back to when they'd first arrived. She'd taken a cursory glance at the layout of the station. Were there any other completed portions that led to the bay? Any at all? Maybe. Yes. There was one, I think. It's a long way around, but... But what other choice did she have? Pivoting on her heel, her boots squeaking against the grates, she rounded the corner again and gasped. "What's happening?" Daniel demanded. The hall was coated in facehuggers. It was 360 degrees of writhing, pale forms, all hurrying in her direction. Collectively, they gave the impression of a giant gulping throat ready to swallow her down. So many. Too many. "You gotta trust me, kid. Please trust me." He nodded against the back of her neck. She spun again, sprinting for the vines. The curtain of facehuggers quivered, excited shivers of anticipation coursing through them in communal delight. One of the breeders swayed, rocking the flexible pipe back and forth before it tensed, flinging itself at her like a rock from a sling. Biting out, yelling behind her clenched teeth, she fired. She shot the sucker out of the sky and kept firing. She blew hole after hole into the mass of dangling station innards, still running full force. By the time her firearm was empty, a fall of acid and wire scraps rained down across the floor, eating away the deck and creating a dangerous chasm. As the bits and pieces of the broken creatures that still clung near the ceiling oozed more acid, the hole grew wider. The gap in the floor stretched to 8 feet across, then broadened to 10. "This is gonna hurt, so..." Dropping the rifle, she swung David off her back, swiveling his arms around her neck so she could clutch him to her chest instead. She kept sprinting. Another few steps, and she'd have to dive or fall. 3, 2, 1. Her boot slipped on the liquidized floor, tripping her, stealing her momentum as she sailed over the gap. Acid sprinkled her back, searing her spine, burning her muscles from the outside, just as panic and rush had burned them from within. At the last moment, she gave Daniel an extra shove, violently propelling him to the other side of the hole. The edge of the melted floor struck her squarely in the midriff. Dregs of acid that still remained on the metal tore at her stomach, but she hooked her fingers into the grooves of the flooring grates and pulled, hauling herself onto steady ground. Mind fogged, body aching, skin sizzling, all she wanted to do was stay where she was. To rest. For it to be over now. Shock tried to overtake her. There was too much pain in too many places. She shut her eyes. But then there were hands on her shoulders and neck. Small hands and big hands. Shouts. Demands. Something like, "Hurry, hurry, they're coming." It was Ribar, and the ship pilot. "Come on, get up," Ribar demanded, his son now in his arms. "They're still coming." Amatz felt like all she could do was crawl. Now that the kid was safe, everything seemed worth it. They could leave her, and she'd... He slapped her face, right across her new acid scars. "Damn it, General, it's my job to keep you alive, and I haven't failed yet." "One more push. You can do it. You're a goddamned general in the U.S. Colonial Marine Corps. You can get up off your ass and stay alive.
She accepted the pilot's hand, struggling to get up. Her legs didn't want to work anymore. Acid on the back of her knees had burned out the joints. Ribar lent a hand, helping to drag her. The skittering of facehugger feet drew closer and louder, nearly drowning out the emergency siren. The bay door opened just as the first alien attempted to leap across the chasm. It landed stealthily on the other side. 5, 10, 20 followed. Amontz kicked her useless legs, trying to gain some purchase, trying to go faster. Daniel made it through the door, then Ribar, then the pilot. Ribar started closing the doors before the general's legs were through it. If the doors closed on her legs, they'd jam, and the facehuggers would have a way in. The order for them to leave her was on the tip of her tongue. "Run, go, I'm already dead, you don't have to die." Ribar had tried. She couldn't ask for more. He'd done his damned job. A hugger grabbed her boot. The beginning of the horde had reached her. She registered the sharp crack of Ribar's service pistol firing long before she noticed the hole in her foot. Hell, what was one more bit of flesh gone? What was one more... Her body got tired of fighting, tired of consciousness. She blacked out. When she came to, the half-constructed space station was in their rear window. Her ears rang with the new silence, and her body felt light. She'd been laid out on a surgical table. White bandages covered nearly every inch of her from head to toe. Every bit of her was numb. Whatever drugs they'd given her were damned strong, and, she had to admit, damned effective. Ribar sat nearby, with Daniel on his lap. Both of the boy's arms were bandaged from where the acid had caught him when they dove. "We didn't think you were gonna make it," Ribar admitted to her. "Neither did I." "So much for our quick tour, eh? I would guess that we'll no longer be endorsing the company's new construction techniques." She managed a dry chuckle. "Yeah. And you know what else? I'm never going on a milk run again." Ribar smiled. "No kidding. How are you feeling, General?" She pursed her lips and set her jaw. She felt fuzzy, spacey, mad at the world, and very much like she knew too intimately how hot dog meat was made. She was glad to be alive, but also a little tired of actually having to be alive. She felt so many things at once, she couldn't pick one. Amontz shrugged, let out a little sigh, and said, "I'm fine." She wondered what a lie detector would make of that.
Deep Black by Jonathan Mayberry. We came in low and fast, using the storm to hide us. Lightning crackled around us, and heavy winds tried to knock us down, but Lulu was on the stick, and she could pilot a falling star through hell itself. Was it a good landing? No, but we didn't die, so put it in the win category. I wanted to bring a full platoon with me, but during the mission briefing, it was determined that a 3-man team had a better chance than a platoon or even a squad. What they called a low-impact intrusion for surveillance and intelligence gathering with potential for targeted response. Typical military action report language that basically meant we had to go in, see what was what, and either come out with intel or pull some triggers. No possible estimates of the risk levels, because we didn't know what we were dealing with. The Arena Fury 161 wasn't our world. It didn't belong to the suits at Weyland-Yutani. Not anymore. Long time ago, it had been a mining facility run by a WT private prison firm, with the inmates doing hard labor mining raw minerals, mostly lead and iron, then smelting, forming, and shipping it off-world. When they found lead on 700 asteroids and dwarf planets, all of which had lower gravity and therefore less cost to put product into orbit, the big world-based mines got shut down. The Fury miners were mostly shipped out, but a group elected to stay. A bunch of religious assholes who'd found Jesus and wanted to wait for Jesus on a rock that was as close to salvation as a pimple on the devil's taint. For some reason, that made sense to them. But they were double-X losers, so don't look too close at the logic, or you'll hurt yourself.